Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at Plexaderm, and we have a special guest, CNN's Brian Stelter, who is chief media critic for CNN.
They say chief media correspondent, yeah, and I can bore you to death by telling you why I like the word correspondent.
Okay, well, don't. But you are a busy, busy guy. There is so much stuff. Where do we start? Let's start at random at Fox News. You're writing a book about Fox News.
I am writing a book about Fox News, and the story keeps getting more and more interesting. The reason why I like the word correspondent is I always want to be analyzing or even criticizing from a perspective of reporting. You know, I want to come at this having talked to a dozen sources and then tell you what I've concluded. And with Fox, I'm obviously speaking with dozens and dozens of sources in and outside the network, trying to write about Fox in the Trump age, because the place has changed a lot. And I think Shep Smith shocking everyone by quitting last week is just the latest example of that.
Yeah, let's talk about the Shep Smith resignation, because on one level, it was not totally surprising considering that there was the Civil War going on and there was the back and forth with Tucker Carlson, but it was a genuine shock the way he did it. I mean, how many people walk away from a $15 million a year job basically on the spot?
I really can't think of another time in television when this has happened. I mean, people almost always leave because they are forced out. You know, they're forced to walk the plank. And in this case, you know, was there pressure of some kind? Did he feel unwelcome at Fox? I think that's an open question, and I wish he would answer it at some point. But he says that executives at Fox asked him to stay, and executives at Fox say the same thing. So he at least wasn't being explicitly pushed off the plank. He, to some degree, chose to walk. And that is exceptionally rare. You know, there is something about television. Once you are on, you don't want to get off. There is something about the red light that is an addictive quality. And that is partly why folks who leave television try so hard to come back. And that's what makes this decision all the more remarkable, I think.
Now, some of the previous reporting had been that there was this real tension among the Murdochs about which direction to go. And the suggestion was that, you know, higher ups in the family might have had his back. And clearly, given what happened last week, it appears that to the extent there's a civil war, it's pretty much over and the Tucker Carlsons have won. Does that overstate it?
It may overstate it a little bit, but I hesitate to even say a little bit because we don't know what Fox is going to do with the time slot. You know, Fox says they're going to put a newscast on at 3 o'clock, but we're going to have to wait and see who they hire and why and what they do at that hour. Right now, losing Shep at 3 is a severe blow for the news operation, and it does speak to the ascendance of the opinion shows, which has been happening for years, I know, and this is just another step in that direction, but it's such a dramatic step that it really shook the news operation staffers in a big way. And by the way, they are still shaken up. My phone is still ringing every day with people who are really worried about what's going to happen to the news part of Fox News. And look, I guess I should just say this. I know some people think there is no such thing as a Fox News operation. I think there is. I think there are dozens of really hardworking journalists there who are trying their best in a uncomfortable environment where news has been squeezed out and opinions been getting more and more powerful. I think there's great writers for FoxNews.com. I think there's great correspondents, but they are in a awkward work environment because the Fox News part is getting smaller and the Fox opinion part is getting bigger. And I think Shep resigning is a huge milestone of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. And doesn't this reflect, though, what's been going on in conservative media, including from the audience? We focus on from the top down, but also from the bottom up, that conservative consumers of Fox News and other conservative media want Fox News to be a safe space for them. They want to tune on, and they want to have the president defended. They want to have his critics attacked. And my gut sense is there's a growing intolerance for the dissenters. So to a certain extent, you know, this has been coming for some time, that there is no real viable business model for anti-Trump voices in certain conservative media that, you know, depend on a conservative base audience.
And I think Shep was feeling that on a daily basis. And it was incredibly uncomfortable at times. You know, I tell people that when you work for CNN or you work for MSNBC, you know you've got critics out there, but they are not your own viewers. The hate mail that I get does not come from regular CNN viewers. It mostly comes from people that hear clips about me on Hannity's show and others like that. But when you work for Fox News and you're a news anchor, you get hate mail from your own viewers. You get death threats from your own viewers. And that is the difference. And the reason that happens is because the president and his allies are constantly saying that you're the bad guys. And I think that's a really messed up situation on multiple levels, not just for Shep, but for others as well. When these news anchors at Fox are targeted by the president, their own viewers turn against them. And that speaks to the intolerance that you were describing. I had Amanda Marcotte on my program on Sunday. She comes from the left. She comes from Salon. She said, what we are experiencing is audiences that are rejecting the truth because they prefer Donald Trump and his lies. They like, quote, I'm quoting her, they like Fox News best when it is echoing Donald Trump and his dishonesty. I thought that was a good way to put it. You know, that's the version of Fox that Fox viewers really want. If you look at the ratings for a day in the life of Fox News, 4 a.m. is the bottom point, about 500,000 viewers. And then it takes off like a rocket ship when Fox and Friends comes on. It is like a rocket ship straight up into the air. The ratings are up to 2 million viewers. And then it starts to come back down at midday. And it really started to come down around Shep's hour. That's usually the lowest rated hour of the daytime lineup, Shep's hour, because a lot of loyal Fox fans either don't want to hear it, or maybe they're out cutting the grass that hour. Oh, there's lots of reasons, right? That was their golf tee time, or they're out running errands. But for whatever reason, Shep's hour was usually the lowest rated hour of the day. And then viewers come back for Cavuto, and then they really come back for the 5. The 5 is incredibly popular. And of course, that's a pretty explicit opinion show, largely weighted to the right. Basically, it is a almost direct correlation. The more opinionated the show, the more pro-Trump the show, the bigger the audience for Fox.
So does this leave people like Neil Cavuto and Chris Wallace kind of hanging out there as on islands now on Fox?
This is the part that I'm trying to report on more for my book right now. I want to learn more about what the Cavutos of the world are thinking, because he obviously is not a raging pro-Trump host. He views this from a business and a journalism lens. And I think he's tried to find a path all his own. I think Chris Wallace is in a unique spot because he's on Fox broadcast on Sunday mornings. So he's insulated from a lot of these issues. And by the way, the issues with Shep, if I can just take it back 6 years, I think it actually goes back 6 years. And I haven't had time to explain this on my television show. So let me take the chance. Shep started to be, I don't want to say marginalized, but I think that's probably the fair word, 6 years ago, well pre-Trump. You know, he used to have a 7 p.m. hour called the Fox Report. And he was moved to 3 p.m. in part to give Megyn Kelly a higher profile when she was going to prime time. So Shep goes from 7 p.m. to 3 p.m. They say he's going to be the big breaking news anchor, and that he's going to break into the other hours whenever anything good or bad happens. Well, that didn't work out very well. I mean, yes, it happened sometimes, but the other anchors, the other hosts in the other hours didn't really want to share their time slots. He didn't break into programming very often. There were some tensions, and I think Shep kind of settled for a job that was valuable to him, certainly profitable, certainly something he enjoyed doing and something he thought was important, but his title was chief news anchor, but he had an hour a day. He wasn't a leader on air visually, even though he was a moral leader behind the scenes. And I think that predated Trump, and then it worsened in the Trump years as he became one of the only folks willing to really, really bluntly fact check and provide a reality check to the rest of the programming. I had a source say to me that, you know, he used to be in it for the money, but in the Trump years, he actually was in it because he was trying to counter all the stuff that was there in the rest of the day. And I thought that was a really interesting point of view. Now, others may dispute that, but the idea that he was in it because he needed to counter the rest of the programming, I mean, man, I can't think of a lot of other places on TV where that's happening.
Yeah, that's like spinning into a hurricane. So is there anxiety on the part of the Fox executives that if they move too far, allow too many anti-Trump voices, that they might face a real challenge from an even Trumpier news network like One America Now, which is kind of a fringy outfit, but which is clearly there. And every once in a while, you know, you get a little head fake from Trump that maybe we ought to, you know, spend more time going over there. And if this is what the audience wants, that's a threat to them, isn't it?
I think it is a threat on the periphery or on the edges. I'll take it two ways. I'm looking at an email here from Charles Herring, who's the head of One America News Network, OANN, and he had emailed me last week with an article. It's titled, Why Trump is Flirting with Abandoning Fox News for One America. Right, and that's obviously what he wants out there. That is in his interest, clearly. Last week, One America actually bought an ad in this cable digest called Cable Facts that a lot of executives get. And it said, it's time to give your subscribers a brilliant source of news. It was quoting the president, calling OANN brilliant. You know, the problem OANN has is they're not in every household yet. So that's why they took out this ad saying, carry our channel. Give our channel to your subscribers. Here in New York, for example, I have Charter, and I don't have OANN on my cable lineup. But it is in tens of millions of homes, even if it's hard to find sometimes. So I think Fox views it as an issue on the periphery. It's OAN is not really chewing into Fox's ratings. There's no evidence that it's eroding its ratings. But it is there, and it is something that Fox has to be somewhat aware of. I think Fox would dispute that they think about the channel at all. I went through this when I wrote about the ratings for One America News, which are very, very low, to the point that they're really not measured by Nielsen. But Herring, he makes the argument that the audience is growing and that in the homes where the channel is available, that it actually is doing decently and is growing its audience. And there is some truth to that. It doesn't have a big audience, but it doesn't have zero either. It's there. It's an issue on the edges, just like Newsmax, just like The Blaze, and maybe someday Trump TV. I don't know.
Someday. So you've talked to Peter Weiner on your show, right, about Trump World and the defenders of Trump.
Oh no, I said Weiner. Did I mispronounce his name?
Oh, I don't know. You know what? I probably am. It's 50-50. He has an interesting. I think he has an interesting psychological profile, which would also explain why, as Trump gets in deeper trouble, as he becomes more unhinged, as his lies become more indefensible, that psychologically there's almost a reaction that people must defend their defense, that they rally around and become even more intolerant of those dissenting voices and more linked to, you know, the voices who are going to keep them in that alternative reality silo that we've seen form over the last couple of years. Do you buy that?
I thought that was an incredible assessment from him. I know he's written about this, and the way he said it on my program on Sunday was so striking. He said, having made the accommodation to Trump early on, hoping that things would get better, that he would grow in office, people don't feel they can get off the Trump train now. So he said, now it's not just a defense of Trump, it's a defense of their defense of Trump. And so to indict him is to indict themselves. And that's hard for any human being. And that's what Peter said. And I was so struck by that.
It's very powerful.
Whether you like Trump or you don't, whatever you think about politics, we can all put ourselves in those shoes and know the feeling. I actually think I'm happily married, but I think back to the days when I was dating and, you know, you're dating the wrong person and you're in denial about it and you don't want to admit it and you don't want to break up with the person. You know, there's a lot of versions of this in life that we can all relate to. And it does make me wonder if there's a way to get at that. I wonder if there's a way to poll on it. I wonder if there's a way to research it to know of the folks that say they are Trump supporters right now, how many of them are feeling what Peter's describing?
Yeah, and how many of them would ever
admit
that?
Can they recognize it? Yeah, can they recognize it and can they grapple with it? And I'm sure it's not the first time it's happened with a politician. I'm sure there are times in the past where people have maybe regretted their support, but not been able to verbalize it. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's also why when you have sort of the nagging conscience that maybe you are wrong, the person you resent most is the person who doesn't go along with you. Okay, we have a lot of other things. I want to talk about this violent video. I want to talk about ABC. I want to talk about Ronan Farrow. We got a lot of stuff. Let's hear from our sponsor first.
Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery, just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends, and the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to triplexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit triplexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's triplexiderm.com.
Okay, we're back with Brian Stelter from CNN. So let's talk about, since it's still top of mind, this bizarre, violent video that apparently has been around for a year. I see some of the rationalizers say, "Oh, it's an internet meme. It's been there for a very, very long time. Why are you making a big deal of it?" And it's just a parody of that scene from Kingsman. But it is truly amazing watching 2 minutes of the image of the President of the United States as a serial killer in a mass murder in a church, killing political opponents, critics, and pretty much everybody from the news media. So I guess the question is, you know, is this a big deal? Are we making too much of it? Or is it really creeptastic?
I was trying to figure that out as I was flying back from LA to New York on Sunday night. I was hoping to have a day off on Monday, but when I landed in New York, I had to go straight to the studio for the CNN morning show to talk about this. And as I was in the car, I was thinking, am I going to be part of the problem? Like, am I going to hype or talk about, or, you know, just by virtue of condemning this video, am I part of the problem giving this attention? And I love the way Charlie Warzel explained it for the New York Times. He said, you know, yes, so much of meme culture, this meme controversy, it's breathtakingly dumb. You know, it's a childish video. He said responding to the trollish world of MAGA memes is a lot like arguing with a child.
Yeah.
But he said the grim reality is that the conspiratorial hate we see online is leaking out into the physical world. And when I saw Charlie write that, I thought that's the point right there. That the sick stuff that happens online does impact our real world politics. No, we are not as hateful a country as we look like we are on Twitter and YouTube. But some of that hate is spilling into our real lives. Look no further than the bombs and the threats and the attacks and the arrests that we've seen of people threatening newsrooms and threatening journalists. So I think that's ultimately why the video matters. It's because we are seeing what happens when these seeds of hate are sown and planted.
Yeah, I do think people trying to minimize it, but do understand that there are people who, and it doesn't take a lot of people, who begin to internalize that kind of hatred, that kind of violent sense that these are not just the enemies, but these are the enemies that, you know, that must be stomped. And there is an element, and again, I can't put a number on it, an element of Trump support that really, you know, for them, this is, you know, inflicting pain on the left, going after these folks. I thought Jonathan Last had a great piece in our publication, The Bulwark, where he said, you notice that, you know, these are not the actual enemies of the country. It's not ISIS. It's not Assad. It's not Putin. It's not President Xi of China. It's not anybody else. It is Democrats. It is the media, because, you know, the domestic enemies are where all of this emotional energy is put. Okay, another thing that you have talked about, and I think it's one of those, you know, deep sigh moments. ABC News has apologized for, I'm going to describe it as a horrific mistake.
My sigh. I hope my sigh doesn't break the speakers here.
You know, this is, we live
in Kentucky. Yeah. They said the video is from Syria. Are you serious?
Yeah. Shocking footage Monday and Sunday, supposedly from the frontline battle between the Kurds and the Turks. But it turned out it came from a gun range in Kentucky. I mean, that is an F up of almost epic proportions. And I guess the question is, first of all, do you have any idea how that happened?
The theory that I've heard from two sources is that the video was maybe given to an ABC News crew in Syria by a source, by an intermediary, by a fixer. I don't know by who, but, you know, there are situations when you're covering stories like this where you're getting video content from stringers, from local sources on the ground. and that apparently the ABC crew that was on the ground was given this video by someone else. I don't know by who. And then it made its way back to New York and made its way onto Good Morning America and World News Tonight. The question, if that's the case, and this came from two different people, so I think it's the right answer, is that why was there not double and triple and quadruple checking in New York or D.C. to confirm that this was real and legit and where it came from? That's the disturbing part to me. I think it totally appropriate for this ABC crew in the conflict zone to take the video, send it into the headquarters. But once it's at the headquarters, you got to figure out the sourcing.
Yeah, and that's the failure. Well, this raises all kinds of questions, including how much misinformation might be coming out of the Middle East. And are we going to get to a point where we can't believe any of these images that we see that are going to be coming out if in fact this kind of misinformation is out there? And secondly, you know, if anything ought to be absolutely clear to the legacy media, it's that you really got to get things right, because every one of these mistakes is absolutely weaponized in this ongoing process of delegitimizing fact-based media.
And I was disappointed in ABC for not addressing this more extensively right away for the very reason you just said. This happened, this video aired on Sunday night's World News Tonight, Monday morning's Good Morning America. And there was no correction on World News Monday night, and there was no correction on Good Morning America Tuesday morning. And ABC may say that's because they're still trying to get to the bottom of this, but I think they need to be as clear as they can be, as transparent as possible. If there is disciplinary action, they need to shout it from the rooftops and make sure everybody knows, because that's the only way to repair some of the damage that's been done.
So speaking of, now I know, and I want to make it very, very clear, you are not a spokesman for CNN, and this is not your job.
But, well, this must be a good question then. Oh, boy.
Well, you know what it is. It's the you know, Project Veritas guys with their undercover expose of CNN, in which they have audio of your boss, Jeff Zucker, talking about impeachment, other folks saying, you know, how much people in CNN were depressed after the election and how he's got a thing for Donald Trump. Any thoughts or internal reaction to being the target of that? Because, of course, this goes viral on the right to confirm everything anyone has ever said about CNN.
I liked what the actual spokesman for CNN, Matt Gornick, said on Twitter. He tweeted out one word. He said, "Yawn." And that was actually one of my reactions as well. I don't think that O'Keefe has published anything surprising or newsworthy. For example, he has a staffer claiming that maybe somebody was crying in the D.C. bureau on the night of the president's election. Well, you know, we had a dozen Democratic commentators sitting around, you know, liberals who were paid to be liberals on the air and support Hillary Clinton. Maybe that's who was crying. I just think there's no there to these claims that O'Keefe is promoting. But it is interesting to see how he tries to warp and manipulate public opinion in this way. It's unfortunate. And I think all we can do is just stay steady and keep doing our jobs.
Okay, you know? Here's a related question. And I don't know that there is one answer, but why do you think Donald Trump is so obsessed with CNN? Okay, so now I'm under contract to MSNBC, and from his point of view,
I wish I could have you on my show.
We are way worse. I mean, we are way worse than CNN from his point of view, and yet he doesn't really bother attacking MSNBC. He seems just relentlessly focused on CNN. Why do you think?
I just had a couple educated guesses, and one is that CNN, because it was the first of the cable news channels, is the Coca-Cola. You know, it's the generic brand, for lack of a better word. It's also developed and sought a reputation as being the middle of the road channel, while MS is certainly more explicitly liberal in its prime time. You know, I think he views CNN as the channel that, you know, it does show up at the airports, right? It is that channel that all those sorts of places. What people don't know about CNN is that it actually reaches more people in a given month than Fox News. The average ratings for Fox are higher at any given time because it has a really, really loyal audience. But people see CNN out, you know, all month long, so it has a larger cumulative audience. I think the president knows that and recognizes that. He certainly cares about the international reach of the channel as well, as he tweets about that. And then I think it also comes down to that explanation we've heard from Maggie Haberman and others, that the president cares about news products that he grew up with. Time Magazine, The New York Times, CNN, you know, brands that have been around for 30, 40, in this case, 30 years. And obviously the other explanation is his relationship with Jeff Zucker, the head of CNN, who was the head of NBC in The Apprentice days. You know, that relationship is clearly a factor I don't know if it's a big factor or a small factor, but it does seem that the president makes this very personal and sometimes attacks Zucker.
Okay, so other big media story, Ronan Farrow's book drops. And he's of course, absolutely everywhere and really has gotten into a war of words with NBC. And but he has revelations about the National Enquirer. I mean, this seems to have a pretty large blast radius in media circles, doesn't it?
It does. And I think it's because there's been a mystery for 2 years about why Farrow was able to walk out the door with his reporting about Harvey Weinstein. That's been a mystery ever since he published his story in The New Yorker. And there's obviously competing explanations, and that's all presented in the book and in the coverage of the book. Farrow, for the first time, is basically alleging, and I'm going to paraphrase here, he's basically alleging that NBC was trying to keep its own secrets covered up, and so it was wary of pissing off Weinstein and publishing a story about Weinstein and going to the mat for this story. He calls it a corporate cover-up. NBC says that is BS and offensive to suggest. And I've read the book. I've talked to NBC executives. I've written a bunch of stories about this. I don't know if I'll ever have a 100% confident answer of what happened.
Really?
I think it is quite possible. You know, there's a natural push and pull between editors and reporters every day. You know, I say the nastiest, well, no, I don't want to say that. You know, one minute I'm cursing at my editor. The next minute I am telling my editor he's the best person I've ever worked with. And that's true. There's a natural tension, right? You want to get a story out fast. You want to get a story up. Ronan was pushing really hard to get his Weinstein reporting out. This might have just been an extreme example of that natural tension between reporter and editor. Or, as Farrow alleges, maybe there was a dirty deal between NBC and Weinstein. But the problem is that he does not have a smoking gun. Yes, he has a lot of circumstantial evidence. He has sources that say something went wrong here. But the bottom line is he doesn't have a smoking gun. And so I don't think we can ever... We can't say definitively that we know what happened. And NBC's account of what happened is simply he didn't have it. His reporting was not solid enough.
And yet he did walk out and within weeks publish something in The New Yorker that won a Pulitzer Prize.
So here's the counter to that. Mm-hmm. The counter is that once he went to The New Yorker and The New York Times published its story about Weinstein 5 days earlier, that created a lot more room for sources to feel free to speak. Mm-hmm. To the theory, and this is NBC's theory, is that those sources who were not willing to give their names all of a sudden were willing to give their names when the New York Times published the story. Okay. Yeah. You know, I think Ronan and David Ehrman have a different account of this. What I'd recommend to people is definitely read the book. It's a fascinating book to read, but also read NBC's account of what happened and try to figure out where you end up. I think I end up in that mushy spot in the middle where you say there was a natural push and pull between an editor and a reporter, or in this case, a reporter and a network, and it went off the rails, and both sides ended up distrusting the other, which is really unfortunate. Like that's actually quite sad, like on a human level, because Farrow is a great reporter, and NBC is an incredibly strong network.
Yeah, and anyone who's ever worked in a newsroom environment, I think, understands the point you're making here, because you know those things can become people get very personally invested in the story, and there is a legitimate pushback, and it can be really very very tense. There is no question about it, you know, that it can be tense.
And that tension usually is helpful, right? That tension is a good thing. The times when I am up against my editors trying to get a story up right away and they're holding me back, I almost always admit later they were right. So that tension is usually a good thing.
It is often a good thing. I still resent stories that were killed back in the 1970s that I wrote that I thought were the best. Let me ask you a more cosmic question, because I sense you are deeply frustrated by something that also deeply frustrates me. I've been thinking about the quote from Leslie Stahl early in the Trump presidency, where she said that Trump basically said he attacked the media because when they came up with bad stuff, nobody would believe them. That this process of delegitimizing the media has been very, very conscious. I mean, I think he enjoys it. I think he viscerally, enjoys attacking the media. It's obviously good politics. but that the president really has laid the groundwork for this moment by convincing a huge portion of Americans not to believe anything they hear, see, or read. And it creates an extraordinary moment where no matter how good your journalism is, there's 40% of the country that is just not going to listen to you. And so we've thrown around words like post-factual politics, but we're in an extraordinary place right now, aren't we? How do you break through that?
I think the president's years-long effort to delegitimize the press was leading up to a moment like this.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
A moment just like this, where he is in a hole 10 feet deep, and for some reason he keeps on digging, where the evidence against him is piling up, where impeachment proceedings are accelerating. And the effort to deem all of us as enemies and all of us as fake is precisely intended to help him through a period like this. I was just on stage at a conference talking with media folks, and what I said, I said, I'm trying to be optimistic up here. I said, look at the polling. Most Americans clearly see through the lies. If you make people choose between Trump and the media, which obviously is a BS choice, like it's a silly pollster question, but if you ask it, most people choose the media. And the Trump's approval rating speaks to the limits of his attempt to destroy truth. That said, clearly there's a portion of the population that is with him incredibly strong, intensely. And I used to say, I guess this time last week, I would say, well, at least Shep Smith is on Fox.
Mm. Yeah, right? that window is closing. I mean, there were a couple of little doors you could get information into some of those silos. But the direct quote from Leslie Stahl was, "You know why I do it?" He said, "I do it to discredit you and demean you all, so that when you write negative stories about me, no one will believe you." And I really find reading Hannah Arendt and The Origins of Totalitarianism, I know that sounds extreme, I find it so relevant today. But she described it this way. In an ever-changing, incomprehensible world, the masses had reached the point where they would at the same time believe everything and nothing, think that everything was possible and nothing was true. I was like, oh, no.
And it does feel like we're pretty close to there.
It does. So are you optimistic or pessimistic?
There's days where, I'm an optimist by nature, but there's days where it's hard to be.
See, I can envision you, because I can envision my inner self doing this, turning to the camera someday and say, just saying, I'm mad as hell and I can't take it anymore.
I'm not that, but I have had a couple of moments where I've come so close to cursing on the air, and I've had to kind of pull myself back from that edge. I actually think that I had that moment like 2 weeks into the Trump presidency, or no, actually like 4 days in. Do you remember early in January, kind of late in January 2017, when the president said 5 million people voted illegally?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I looked back and I realized that's the moment where it changed for me, where I no longer believed that Reince Priebus was going to keep this on a center lane. You know, that was the moment where I said afterwards, I said, this is crazy. There is no other way to describe that claim but crazy. And I remember I shook a little bit on the air, because it's so uncomfortable to say things like that. I don't know if you still feel this way, but it's so uncomfortable to say he's lying to you again. Like, what he just said is not just untrue, it's crazy. That's uncomfortable to say as a trained reporter. But it's also necessary. It's also necessary to say.
It is necessary to say it. And of course, that was just the beginning. And now we're 3 years into this, and you still have those moments where you go, why are you not seeing this? Why are you not seeing this? So, but you have to do it on television. I can do it on a podcast. So,
Well, I think we've seen great innovation in cable news in the past few years as a result. You know, a lot of these anchors, myself included sometimes, are doing these monologues at the start of the show to try to put some facts on the table before we get started. I think it's great that anchors on MS and CNN and elsewhere are standing up for, you know, basic decency, right? That's not something we think about oftentimes as journalism, right? Newsrooms are certainly raucous places, but I do think that journalists, like other, leaders in the country, can stand up for basic values like decency, and that's crucial right now. But I also, the other reason why I'm a little optimistic, or I hesitate to put all of this on the responsibility of the press, is that a lot of this, I think, is the responsibility of our elected political leaders as well, right? Let's take impeachment, for example. Journalist's job is not to advocate, at least journalists, you know, who work in newsrooms for a living, not our job to advocate for an outcome. It's simply our job to advocate for a well-informed public. And it's really up to the Democrats to figure out how to counter Trump's message. And whether, you know, Trump's very effective at his talking points, I'm always interested to see if the Democrats are able to figure out their communications methods to match Trump. Because that's where I think it's not our job as reporters in newsrooms like CNN, it's the job of the Democrats. And to some degree, the job of pundits on TV, right? Guests on TV to communicate, but not the job of journalists. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. But don't let the Republicans off the hook as well. I mean, maybe we've just internalized the fact that Republicans are never going to say, you know, are never going to speak up, or are never going to say what they're actually thinking about all of this. Because I do think that that would also, you know, temper to have people who, in theory, at one point had a lot of this base, had their trust, had their ears, and you know, but what a strange moment that they're all afraid to speak out. Well, keep up the work. In case our listeners aren't aware, you have a daily newsletter which I've told you in the past I regard as a must read. I've actually stayed up late waiting for it to come out.
Good news. It's going to be out early on the day we're taping. So it'll be out early for you.
Excellent. Okay.
Thank you for the plug. People can sign up at reliablesources.com. It is a labor of love. It's the kind of thing. Do you have anything in life like this where when you're working on it, you kind of hate doing it? And then when it's done, you're so proud of it and you're like, okay, I'll do that again tomorrow. That's basically
that describes all writing. You know, people who hate writing but love having written. It is the only way that we could put ourselves through all of that. And you'll feel that way about the book too. You will hate sitting down and writing it, but you will have loved having written it.
Oh, well, I hope I can come back here and tell you you're right when I finish it.
Okay, Brian Stelter, thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast today. Our episode was brought to you by Plexiderm. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow and we will do this all over again.